You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2026 Giro d'Italia.
Cozze ci te le cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze ci te le cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Hello and welcoming you on Tuesday, May the 5th. That is the week when the real ciclismo begins. The Giro d'Italia is on the horizon, our horizon. And in this episode, we are going to glide around the proverbial antechamber of the first grand tour of the season, gracefully distributing cicchetti, or little tasters, ahead of the three-week feast that awaits us. Joining me to do that today is our crack squad for the big outing to Bulgaria and then Italy. A hopefully winning blend of youth and experience, elegance and scruffiness. I think both of the respective parties know who I'm referring to. It is first from Denmark via Liguria, our Jonas Vingegaard correspondent. It is Il Barone, Brian Nygaard.
Hey lads.
Hello, Brian. Yeah,
hello, and thank you. Feels good
for the avoidance of doubt. For the avoidance of doubt, you're the elegant one.
Well, there's a camera on this recording, so I kind of doubt that. But I actually just got back from Denmark and just before that, California. And I sense that the Vingegaard hype is real. So I can confirm that I fit the correspondent role on his Giro at the moment.
Excellent, excellent. But dwarfed by the Paul Sexas hype. And we will be talking about that in a second. But secondly, also joining us from the beating heart of central Italy, the USA has the Big Apple. Italy has the Grande Prosciutto, or Parma. That's where he's from. That's where he hails from. Back for his second Giro d'Italia in the cycling podcast sidecar, it's Michele Pelacci. Pelacci, how are you doing?
Ciao, Daniele. Ciao, Barone. Hi, everyone. We're very, very fine. Actually, we had great weather in Italy in March and April. It's raining now, and I'm not ready for 15 days of rain at the Giro. It's
eek.
It's not looking good.
Eek. And Pelacci's already had his first telling off of the Giro before we started recording. Pelacci and I were recording something yesterday, actually, because we've got Pelacci's excellent Kilometer Zero coming in a few days. And my fiance overheard us, and she said, "Oh, you really treat him like a little brother, don't you?" And I don't know what that... I didn't know quite what to take from that. I thought I was being firm but fair with you yesterday, Pelacci. Hopefully we'll continue in that vein. Brian, let's park our Giro d'Italia chat just for a few minutes, because this is kind of maybe emblematic, maybe says something about the Giro d'Italia, and we'll discuss that later. But in the Giro d'Italia week, yesterday on Monday, the headlines in the world of cycling were dominated by a story that hasn't really got a whole lot to do with the Giro d'Italia. Paul Sexas is going to be riding the Tour de France. As we suspected, there was this lovely announcement on social media, and it is happening. And, well, fast forward to this morning, the following morning, five pages if you include the front page of L'Equipe. Now, I think I'm being a bit of a boomer. I think, Brian, we're being maybe boomers. Well, we can't escape the fact that we're cycling boomers. But when we use L'Equipe as a gauge of how big a story is, how important a story is, because, you know, the written press doesn't have the role that it once did. However, it is some gauge, some indication that this has been huge news. Everyone seems to have an opinion on it. Brian, what's your opinion? What's your feeling?
I was actually, yeah, funny you mentioned it. I was browsing L'Equipe just before we started the recording. I would have been more surprised if he said that he wouldn't do it, to be honest. But the one thing that did surprise me, I would also say in a positive sense, was the content of the announcement that he actually said that he... Yes, he was going, but he was also going for a result. I think that was a really cool statement, and it was a great statement for his narrative, the narrative of Paul Sexas and how he wants to approach his career and take those first steps. And to me, it seemed like a bit like L'Equipe might have pre-produced a little prematurely. You know, the Alexander Ross's comment. I have a feeling he's on vacation and was asked to do a small piece about it, and the headliner that said no pressure, and the key element of the announcement was that he's putting on heaps of pressure on himself because he's racing basically to try and win. You know, he didn't use that expression, but he's racing to the best possible result, and that would be to try and win it. He does balance it, I think, in his comment. Alexander Ross, you know, as you know, Daniel, he's a writer that I rate very highly, by saying that this will probably be the first and only tour that is, I mean, obviously the first, but the only tour that he can race with the possibility of also having a failure. And I sort of also halfway agree with that, but I doubt that he will, to be honest. I think he's such an amazing athlete, and it's not the age that restricts him. You know, he's as ready as anyone, I think. He's just there's a lot of unknowns, and I look forward to seeing those being uncovered.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of the cycling podcast giving Pelacci his debut last year, the youngest man ever to do a grand tour for the cycling podcast at the tender age of, what was it, 27.
But Pelacci. Was he going for a result though?
No, definitely not. He wasn't even going for stages. And Pelacci, you are back this year. You've got more experience this year and greater ambitions. But let's talk about Paul Sexas. Needless to say, you were excited. You're always excited. I saw your Instagram post. What are your thoughts about it? Because Brian makes a good point there. And this is something that's been emphasized, for example, in L'Equipe today. There is an absence from everything that's been said by Sexas and Decathlon of this usual narrative of a young rider being sent to the tour and him being protected and him only going for experience. That has been conspicuously absent from the discourse.
You're right, but I think the main point has to be it was impossible for them not to send him. He's already too big. He has proven too much already not to be brought to the tour, I think. And what the evil people say, what the malicious person say, is that he's leaving anyway at the end of the year, so Decathlon might just squeeze the most of from his image, from his status right now before he leaves for Team UAE. Possibly, I don't know, there's speculations. Also because I heard his brother, Nino, born in 2009, is riding a Colnago bike.
Where did you hear that, Pelacci?
In the, probably in the Sexy Basque episode of the Cycling Podcast. That's too much speculation, but
At least Nino actually appeared in the video yesterday. Paul Sexas's brother appeared in the announcement video yesterday, sitting next to Paul Sexas. I was relieved that he didn't show up in full UAE team kit.
Can I also mention that, which I think is, and there's a lot of good things to be said about the content they produce. I think it's absolutely brilliant. You know, they're just pushing all the right buttons with his grandparents and everything. The setting, it's just really well done. And there's a cat in there also. Can I just say that this boy can do no wrong, right? I mean, they say no pressure. I mean, I think just the narrative is just so on the money right now for this guy.
He's also going to be, I think, the teenager with the most pressure ever, possibly, at a Grand Tour. I remember in Italy, it's pretty famous, the fact that it was Fabio Fellini in 2013, I think. He started the Tour de France at 20 years and few months. He had no pressure at all. This guy has to go for GC. He said, I'm trying to do the overall best result possible. Good luck. I think he's built up for it. He's going to make it. But Jesus, a lot of pressure.
Yeah, indeed. Just as a couple of points of comparison, Eddy Merckx did his first Tour de France at 24 years of age, 12 days in 1969. Tadej Pogacar was 21 years old, 11 months and 9 days when he started the Tour de France that he won in 2020. We're going to talk about Pogacar in just a second, but chaps, it would be remiss of us throughout this spring, we've been covering the phenomenon that is Paul Sexas. We have had a special correspondent who we've been consulting on a regular basis because he has been involved, what we've been hearing, in the Paul Sexas negotiations with Decathlon. I'm of course talking about Emmanuel Macron, I caught up with him yesterday. I'll ask him whether he thinks that Decathlon have made the correct decision in sending Paul Sexas to the Tour de France. Here's what he said.
For sure.
Well, chaps, that's the last time the listeners will be hearing that slightly tired gag for a few weeks. Huge sigh of relief, because we are going to be talking mainly about the Giro d'Italia over the next month. But Brian, or one of us, mentioned Tadej Pogacar a second ago. I mentioned how old he was when he did his first Tour de France. Now, I want to ask you quickly whether you think this is good, bad, indifferent news for Pogacar, that Sexas will be going to the Tour de France. What does it change for him? But just also to say that we should also talk briefly about what we saw at the Tour de Romandie last week. A very, very dominant performance by Pogacar. Won all but two stages, won the overall, and did what we expected him to do. Added another short stage race to his collection. However, there was a bit of talk over the week about him not climbing as well as he had previously. He said he'd put on a little bit of weight because he'd been enjoying bulking up, getting yoked in the gym. And Florian Lipovic looked very solid as well when he pushed Pogacar to a certain extent, particularly on the last day in Les Ains. So, chaps, two things then. Thoughts on Pogacar's performance in Romandie? Should we draw anything from it? And also, Sexas's participation in the Tour de France, what does it mean for the Slovenian, Brian?
Yeah, I think Romandie, we shouldn't read too much out of it. I think it was an extended recovery ride for him after the classics. And I think there's a tendency in the analysis right now to overemphasize each individual performance and then extrapolate something genuine about it regarding the Tour, right? I think if we look at where Pogacar is now in his season and look at, you know, from when he started and started Bianca to now, that's a really long period of time. And think of what he's going into now, you know, having a week off probably at least and then doing altitude. So from where he is, it's an extraordinary performance regardless. And second of all, it's fantastic news for Pogacar that Sexas is doing the Tour. I think that the danger of Pogacar's his popularity is divides cycling to a rather significant degree, and the repetitiveness of him, you know, going on and the trajectory of him winning his fifth Tour could be somewhat distorted if there's not a new element. I don't see Vingegaard might or might not be better than last year. Who knows? And we're still to see what the Giro will do for him in that regard. But I think that there's another exciting element, and there's something else to take a lot of attention, and that the story won't just be, oh, here's Pogacar again doing whatever he wants and you know, riding in circles with everyone else. It's great for Pogacar. And if and when, or maybe, it will change the dynamic of the race, there will be, I think, an added element of excitement regarding who will be the second best, and that could also change how some of the mountain stages will be ridden. I think all of that is great news for Pogacar. I don't think it'll necessarily threaten his potential for winning. I think ultimately he'll be the strongest rider in the end. But I think any news that will take off attention from whatever animosity or whatever one track sort of perspective that's been on him is good news.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Pelati, before I go to you, I just one thing I was going to add that I thought it was Thomas Perrotto, I think his name is in L'Equipe this morning, reminded me of something from the Dauphiné last year. Now, it's easy to look at Liège-Bastogne-Liège and think, oh, Sexas is pretty close to Pogacar, and he could be even closer at the Tour de France because we've been hearing he's been gaining 20 watts a month. But it's not that many months ago that Sexas had his big breakthrough at the Dauphiné, but you know, I was there at the Dauphiné and he was absolutely exhausted at the end. And I remember speaking to him the penultimate night and sort of asked him, well, how are you thinking about tomorrow, the last stage? And he was like, well, I need to pray. And then on the last day, he was so tired after the last stage that he I think the rest of the team rode down the mountain to the team bus and he asked whether he could get in the car and he wanted to, you know, he wanted a pizza straight away. He demanded a pizza straight away. He was absolutely on his feet. On his knees, sorry. So, you know, that's only, that's not many months ago. So there's still, you know, just to ride 3 weeks, that is a significant, significant step up for him. And I think we do need to manage our own expectations a little bit. Pelacci, your thoughts?
It's so interesting how Pogacar has absolutely dominated Romandy, but also it was one day when I woke up with a dream. It was April 27th. It's the day between the end...
Where's this going?
the end of Liège and the beginning of Romandy. One day, I was hoping for Pogacar to look over his shoulder, like the John Travolta meme, you know that?
Like, oh my God.
Why am I going to Romandy? Why am I doing this? Let's go to the Giro d'Italia instead. That was my dream. Not happened, of course. I think Pogacar won all classification at Romandy except one. It's a good trivia question in the next couple of years for a cycling aperitivo. He won all classifications but one. Which one? And who won it?
Young riders classification.
I think, was it there? Was it there probably? I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. He did not qualify. So of course, you know, but he did not win also the KOM classification. 32 years old Swissman, Roland Thalmann of Tudor won that. So
are we still within the realm of your dream here, or are we talking about real life now?
No. A very specific dream, though.
Okay.
Very specific, well done. I know. But I think having Sykes against him at the Tour de France also scares him a bit, because we didn't know yet the end of the potential of Sykes. I'm sorry to say, bring up his name again. We'll do it many more times during the Giro d'Italia. At the end of 2024, which is yesterday or most, Lorenzo Fin and Paul Sykes were almost the same. Lorenzo Fin, the under 23 world champion right now, almost the same. It's just in the last 14, 15 months, Paul Sykes has been boom, an absolute boom. And by the way, I think their first pro win, Pogacar and Sykes, is on Alto de Foglia in Volta Algarve. The same climb, the same course, the same race. Interesting, interesting comparisons.
Indeed.
So what you're saying is that the trajectory that Sykes is on should worry Pogacar for what's coming up in the second part of the tour.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's got to the point in his career, and we've probably talked about this in the last few weeks, but Brian, you talk about the crowd feeling, the French crowds, the crowds at the tour, and there's maybe we've come to a bit of an inflection point over the last couple of years where the hostility towards him starts to increase slightly, just out of boredom, more than anything, boredom with Pogacar. And maybe also the sort of feelings that people have towards the UAE team as well, to a certain extent. And so I think that it's an interesting moment in Pogacar's career from that point of view, but it's also an interesting moment in terms of his motivation, because, okay, we've had the explanations afterwards about why his body language was the way it was in the last week of the tour last year, that he had these knee problems, and you know, also he became more defensive on the bike, but he didn't seem to be enjoying himself as much. And it could be that this is the motivational impulse that he needs for the next phase in his career to work. Yeah.
And this probably shoehorns us a little bit into the Giro eventually, but Vingegaard should probably worry more than Pogacar. I'm sure he's confident that he's doing the right thing doing the Giro, because the other approaches that he's done has only brought him into, you know, being second, significantly second to Pogacar the last couple of years. But I think he's worried more than Pogacar, to be honest.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network in the world. Now here we are on the eve of Grand Tour season. The first big race of the year gets underway in a few days' time, the Giro d'Italia, of course, and Daniel, after he has finished this preview episode, will be packing for Bulgaria and Italy. Now, Daniel travels very light. If he's got his work equipment and his running kit, he's pretty much happy. But I know he will also be metaphorically packing his NordVPN subscription too. As do I, whenever I'm away working for the Cycling Podcast, I have NordVPN on my phone and my laptop, making sure that all of those connections are safe and secure, because I became aware that connecting up to the internet, either on 5G on my phone or in the press room using their Wi-Fi or using the Wi-Fi in the hotel or even those local hotspots where you can get connected, I became a bit concerned about the security of those connections and wanted to make sure that all of my data was safe and secure. Lots of other benefits to NordVPN too. It will keep you safe from malware, phishing attempts and viruses. And so really, if you're surfing the internet, whether you're at home or on the move, a NordVPN subscription is a very good way to keep all of your connections and your data safe and secure. And because you listen to the Cycling Podcast, you can get a fantastic deal when you sign up for a 2-year plan at nordvpn.com/TCP. You'll get 4 months extra for free. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP. Right, back to Daniel for the rest of the preview. From me, please enjoy the Giro d'Italia coverage. Promises to be a great race. And subscribe to the 1101 Cappuccino, which is our Substack. It will be going out periodically through the Giro with lots of updates about the race and what the podcast is doing. The best way to keep in touch with other things that are happening around the Cycling Podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up for the 1101 Cappuccino, and it will arrive free of charge in your inbox whenever I get around to writing a new update.
Incredible. Describe what we've just seen.
It's a mess here. Verre crying on the floor. People following Simon Yates. I don't know, Daniel, it was a climber / rouleur from Australia who won. A guy from Lucano, Marsico Vettere, second. And Simon Yates winning the Giro in third. A podium. We had no clue.
I've never seen Simon Yates emotional, I don't think, in my career. Even the day in 2018 when he lost the pink jersey, he seemed to contain his emotions. But we've just seen him we've heard him on the radio to his teammates, and in floods of tears. What a moment.
Yeah, quite emotional, to be honest. Something that I've worked towards, obviously the Giro itself, many, many years, and a lot of setbacks. And I had an idea today to try something, and managed to pull it off, so quite emotional.
Well, Pelacci, that was you and I a year ago. Where exactly were we? Limone Piemonte, of course, a very famous moment now in the recent history of the Giro d'Italia. 11 short months ago, Simon Yates winning the Giro d'Italia with that extraordinary comeback on the penultimate day. And then Simon Yates pretty much vanished into thin air. But I thought it was worth reminding ourselves of what happened in the Giro d'Italia last year. The fact that Yates is no longer among us in the peloton will maybe sort of lead some people to forget about that amazing finale to last year's Giro d'Italia. But we're going to talk about who might be his successor in just a moment, whether his successor may indeed come from the same team, Visma Lisa bike. That's certainly what a lot of people think is going to happen. Chaps, before we do that, just a couple of things about what's happening this week. So we've got an action-packed week, as always, before the Giro d'Italia a packed week in terms of podcasts. Last week, we had our wine podcast. That was my conversation with Greg Andrews of Divine Cellars. Now I'm going to include information in the show notes about how to order this year's Giro Vagando selection. I'm going to list the wines and the link. I'll give you the website link. It's www.divinecellars. That's all one word, the letter D, then vine, then cellars.com. And you'll find the Giro Vagando selection for 2026 on there. Today is Tuesday. This is our preview. Tomorrow, chaps, it's going to be the second part of my podcast about the 1986 peace race and the link with the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, which happened 10 days earlier. There's also a link there are various links with the Giro d'Italia in that, but that's going to come out tomorrow. And then on Thursday, Kilometer Zero, I think this is just going to be for friends of the podcast. We've got the footnotes, the Giro d'Italia footnotes. This year, it's sort of an hour and 10 minutes. Me in conversation with John Foot from the University of Bristol, Professor of Italian Studies at the University of Bristol, just talking about the country that we are going to be traveling around for the majority of the next month. Again, there are some references to cycling in there, but there's a lot of history and culture, what you would normally expect from John Foot. And we've had him on the podcast for the last several years, and we'll be sort of scattering his insights in our normal podcast throughout the Giro. Indeed, later in this podcast, we'll be hearing from John Foot. I may also footnote that podcast with a conversation I had with Simeon Kishukov of Eurosport Bulgaria, who we're also going to hear from later in the episode. And then on Friday, Pelacci and I will be in Bulgaria. We'll be there from Thursday. And Friday, our daily coverage, on the ground coverage, will kick off. Chaps, it's been an exhausting build-up to the Giro. It's been an exhausting week, hopefully not for the listeners. Hopefully they'll be enjoying all the podcasts we've got coming. But I said we will be talking in this second part mainly about who might succeed Simon Yates in the role of honour of the Giro d'Italia, and whether indeed that successor will come from the same Visma Lisa Bike team. Now, the big favourite is Jonas Vingegaard. Now, Brian, I'm going to go straight to you as our appointed Jonas Vingegaard expert. And the way this is, again, we're going to talk about some media narratives a little bit. And the way this has been presented, couched, has been that Jonas Vingegaard desperately needs this Giro d'Italia for his career, because he's come up against a bit of an immovable object in Tadej Pogacar in the Tour de France. And maybe, although of course he can't say this, maybe he's resigned himself to the fact that he's not going to be Pogacar in the Tour de France, although he's still going to the Tour this year. Is that a sort of misrepresentation of Vingegaard and the Giro? That he needs it desperately.
I mean, he's an extremely accomplished rider, first of all. And I think if you asked him that question directly, I don't think he would confirm it. He's not when you look at sort of the aura of Jonas Vingegaard, there's nothing desperate about him, right? I mean, if it's more the frustration some people have on his behalf, right? But I think that's a frustration you could apply on anyone who's up against Tadej Pogacar, really, apart from Mathieu van der Poel. Everyone comes up short against Tadej Pogacar. It's a generational thing more than anything, I think. If Vingegaard wins the Giro, he's won all three Grand Tours, and that makes him, in my opinion, at least the most accomplished Danish sports person ever. And that in itself, if you take Pogacar out of the equation, is an immense accomplishment. I think he's made a wide choice. That's my personal opinion. I think it's an obvious time in his career to look for other goals. He hasn't missed a lot of targets apart from the Tour, you know, and he has numerous second places, and I think he's done trying to like convince himself that that's his only motivation, and I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, last year he won the Vuelta, he completely misfired at the European Championships, but other than that he achieved his goals. You know, this year with Paris-Nice and Catalunya, he hasn't set a foot wrong. The only thing with the Giro is that he can only really win, right? And it has to be the bullseye, right? He can't really miss this one. And I think that the interesting thing is, if you look at the other approaches, I mean, he's juggled his preparation for the Tour, and you know, some years he's done a different approach, but it's only really brought him to a point where he hasn't been able to challenge Pogacar in the Tour, right? And so I think this approach is obvious, because if and when, I would almost say, he wins the Giro, then he has that in his hands, and then whatever comes at the Tour will be, you know, time will tell. I've said earlier this winter on the podcast that I don't think we'll see much of him after this, after the Tour. I don't think we'll see him in Montreal either, but that's secondary to this. I think it's a wise choice. Desperation, I think, is more a bit interpretation of where others see his career, to be honest. I will doubt, though, that he'll come back to the Giro after this. I think he'll, in a little bit of similar manner as Pogacar, he'll also seek out other races that will be relevant to him. One could be the Olympics in Los Angeles. You know, he's not one to really shine in one day races, but I think if they're hard enough, he'll have a decent chance.
Pellacci, I'll come to you in a second, but Brian, how does he lose this Giro? Because, well, we're going to talk about the route later, but he's such an overwhelming favourite that, again, the narrative is really that it's his to lose. How does he lose it?
Contingencies, really. I think, you know, if you look at the layout of the Giro, it's there's an obvious places for him where he can make a difference. And then chance might throw him a curveball, and then that would be it. I don't really see any pitfalls. I don't see any, you know, there could be crashes, there could be other elements, you know, like I said, contingencies that could deal him a bum hand. But I don't feel that there's other teams that could somehow, in a two-pronged attack, give him any issues. He doesn't really have the strongest team next to him. But I think if he goes into the second part of the Giro, and by that I mean after the time trial, the significantly long time trial at that, with a decent margin, and I think that will be his approach. We'll talk about that later, I'm sure. Then I think he'll have enough to be able to control the race after that, and that will, I think, will be the way forward into Pink in Rome.
Pellacci.
Yeah, just the only. By the way, Daniele, you mixed up previously. You said we were on Limone Piemonte for Simon Yates last year.
Limone Piemonte was the Vuelta, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Where were we?
Yep, El Sestriere, Colle del Sestriere.
Ah, yes.
After Finestre. But who won on Limone Piemonte in La Vuelta, stage two? Jonas Vingegaard.
There you go. I'm a step ahead. I'm playing 5D chess, Pellacci.
Listen, the only reason why I think Vingegaard should lose sul campo, on the field, like against real opponents, no luck involved, is both Jai Hindley and Giulio Pellizzari are stronger than him. It's a super small possibility, will not happen. They have two guys.
You mean together they'll be strong? They could be stronger.
Exactly. So same team, two guys, they can put him like in trouble. But it's not going to happen. In the last Vuelta, there was João Almeida who put him on the rope. Will not be here, João Almeida, this year. Tom Pidcock was third in the Vuelta. Will not be here at the Giro. So it's a pretty good path for Vingegaard at this Giro.
Can you chaps think of a recent example of that? We always talk about this before Grand Tours, of the sum of two parts in one team potentially being able to overpower a superior rider.
Roglic and Vingegaard against Pogacar, but that was more...
argue Vingegaard was stronger.
Yeah, you could. And you could also argue that Pogacar missed his fueling strategy, something severe. Mm. So there are other, but I think that also goes into, you know, being stronger also means that you have to get your fueling right. That's, you know, everything counts. So I think, you know, how Jai Hindley won the Giro on the stage where Lennart Kemner did his masterpiece in helping him out. It was sort of late in the game as well. I think things were relatively open up until then. I'm not sure that Jai Hindley could have done it without Lennart Kemner necessarily that day.
Pellacci, you were saying?
I'm so interested about the evolution of Jonas Vingegaard's sort of narrative arc in this Giro d'Italia, because he's introverted in a race that does not allow, I think, much privacy. I think he'll be exposed. I think his weaknesses, not on the race, on the bike, but also on the outside, will be exposed. I'm talking about, just Italian media being all over him.
Talking to you in the press conferences.
Also, you're right. Me asking stupid questions to him.
Yeah, that would wear anyone down after a few days. We've seen that. We saw that last year with Del Toro. No one talks about that being the real reason he lost the Giro.
The competitive edge got washed out by Pellacci.
he is in total opposite from Pogacar. He is a suffering rider. I think he has a deep level of how can I explain myself, of sofferenza, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sort of suffering and pathos, kind of. Yeah,
exactly. And that's what's interesting me. If you put it in the general Italian media landscape, it's going to be interesting.
I think it's a really valid point. I think it's a valid point. And I think it's one thing that I've talked about in Danish media as well as late as yesterday, the importance of Vingegaard's public persona in Italy and how important it will be for him to carry the pink jersey in a way, not just in a graceful way in the race. I think that's the least of his worries, but to be an interesting character throughout. Let's say that he, for the sake of argument, we'll talk about the route shortly, but if he takes the jersey from Blockhausen onwards, so say like from late in the first week, he'll be basically in the mix zone every day. He'll be in the press conference every day. And we all know how it is with Italian media, and especially with Wright. They want him to personify the Dane conquering Italy. And they want him to talk about how much he loves Italy and whether he likes pasta or pizza the most, et cetera, et cetera. And that's gonna become pretty old hat after 4 or 5 days for Vingegaard, really.
I mean, not for the Italians.
Not for the Italians. So I think in the symbiosis between them trying to wrangle him for more Italian integration and him trying to avoid it, I think that's going to be an equally as big a challenge as trying to understand what Pelacci wants to ask him in the press conference.
It's interesting, chaps, isn't it? I think, one thing I noticed, particularly when you get an introverted character like Vingegaard, is Grand Tours, much more than one-day races, become these kind of extended therapy sessions writ large, where we, the external observers, maybe the old school journalists, we become very interested in someone's body language and the way they carry themselves, and maybe to an excessive degree. And we've certainly seen this, Brian, you know this very, very well from having been a press officer at the Tour de France. That almost becomes the game at a certain point, particularly if there's a dominant figure. You know, I think about the Armstrong years at the Tour, and I notice it a lot with Vingegaard, and it's maybe because in the absence of too much else for the media to concentrate on, they sort of zero, and particularly the foreign press. I've noticed this with the French press and Vingegaard. They really try and zero in and try and sort of pick him apart and dissect him. How's he feeling? Oh, the number of times I've read, oh, it's a different Vingegaard this year. He seems to be much more relaxed. I mean, why does anyone... It's not. And also, who cares? He can be relaxed or not relaxed. I mean, we're there to watch him as a sportsman, winning or losing. Yeah. Like, who cares if he looks a little bit more tense or a little bit more relaxed you know?
I think, in a Grand Tour, even if you're not riding it on a bike, I think you wake up in a different mood every morning. Yeah. I certainly know that I do, Daniel. But I also remember the year when Andy Schleck, you probably weren't born, Pelacci, but when Andy Schleck finished second in the Giro, how it was a breakthrough in his public persona. Right? I mean, I know that Danilo Di Luca, in a non towards way, I suppose, won the Giro that year. But it was a breakthrough for Andy. His persona was like, he was so loved by the Italians. He could do no wrong. He was their favorite little puppy. And, you know, after that, everything was just open for him. You know, he could have dated any girl in the caravan. He probably also did. I mean, everything was just, it was just an absolute joy, you know, for him. It was so easy for him to be in that whole atmosphere. Mm. And I remember the first year when it was Simon Yates, when he didn't win the Giro, right? And he had the pink jersey at a very early part of the race. He won stages and everything. And I definitely sensed that he struggled with that whole narrative, because he you could tell immediately when they did the flash interviews, those are the interviews they do straight after the finish line. You literally barely have a towel in your face. He could not wait to get out of that situation. And he couldn't hide it either. And all of that is something that needs to be managed really carefully by the team.
Yeah. Palacci, as an Italian, are you aware of this, that the Italians, we notice it, Brian and I notice it, and other people talk about it. And I've talked to, I remember speaking a few months ago to Mark Cavendish about it, that to us outsiders, it's very obvious and very pronounced that the Italians have a greater propensity for hero worship than other countries, other cultures. You seem to love and idolize sort of stars, people, put people on a pedestal more than, and I, you know, I'm loath to make generalizations, but again, we all sort of see it, we all notice it.
It's interesting. We are going to read a lot of times on La Gazzetta dello Sport the words Il Vichingo, the Viking, or Il Repescatore.
Il Repescatore.
The Fisherman King. Yeah, the king. Yeah.
Lots of time. But I think general public does not recognize Vingegaard on the same level of Pogacar. So if you say to my grandmother, Pogacar is riding the Giro d'Italia, she'd be like, oh, wow, Pogacar is coming, let's go. If you tell her Vingegaard is coming, she's like, who's this guy?
Can we get that in an audio file? Could you call her up and we can use it as an intro or something?
As always, I'm going to my grandmother before to say ciao, ciao before the Giro
starts. Of course you are.
Is it like a papal blessing?
Exactly. But also I'm interested in Vingegaard because he sometimes is just the most random guy in the world tour. Sometimes he shows up with super short socks or he wears his bibs over the t-shirt on his way to win Paris stages. That's so interesting. I can't wait for that. Something's going to happen. I don't know what. Something is going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, there is an element that I think the Italians are going to, maybe even your grandma, Palacci, if he brings his entourage, his family, right? I mean, that's something, that's an asset that Pogacar couldn't produce just yet. And I think if Vingegaard is going to tour the Giro with his family, as he often does in Grand Tours, then I think the Italians, or some at least, will take to that and have warm feelings about.
The one element in this Giro d'Italia who could overshadow all of this is an emerging Italian star. Giulio Pellizzari has been getting better, getting stronger. He's just won his first stage race, professional stage race tour of the Alps. And Palacci, you've been a big evangelist for Pellizzari for a couple of years now. I'm also a big admirer of the way he's ridden the last couple of years. And I think he's in a similar fashion to Lipovits. I see him as someone who's very, very solid and very consistent. And that's a really good sign. He's 6 days older than Isaac Del Toro, still very young. Obviously, he's the sort of generation underneath Pogacar. But, you know, this could be a huge moment for him. It could be a huge moment for Italy as well, because the last Italian winner was Vincenzo Nibali 10 years ago. That's the longest drought ever without an Italian winner. The previous longest drought was only 5 years. So we're already at double that. And I was thinking to myself a couple of days ago, you know, we're talking about Paul Sex, that's Tour de France, 41 years. It seems very presumptuous at this stage to imagine there could be a drought that long. But we see the sort of direction of travel in world cycling and Italian cycling. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility that 10 years could become 15, could become 20. But Pellizzari, I thought he would be Vingegaard's biggest challenger for the Giro. And I still think that. And we talked about Red Bull and the options they've got. Hindley's going to be there. We think Vlasov is going to be there as well. They haven't announced their team yet. And they also this year have been racing very sort of on the front foot. And I think probably Zach Dempster, who's their new head of racing, has got a lot to do with that, because we saw that last year when he was at Ineos and he sort of changed the way the team was riding. They were very aggressive. And that's an exciting prospect, I mean, how, Palacci, how much potential do you think Pellizzari has in this Giro? Could he challenge Vingegaard?
I hope so. It will be tough. I think Vingegaard has the long time trial that can take a lot of minutes on Pellizzari. But Giulio Pellizzari has been on the rise ever since his first Giro d'Italia in 2024 with Bardiani. He challenged Pogacar on Montepana, that climb, and he was sixth two times in two Grand Tours last year. I think he can and must aim at the podium in this edition. Will he make it? It's tough. I think as soon as he will be close to Pogacar, he'll be getting lots of attention from Italian media as well. That can, I don't know if he will, but it can sort of, you know, destabilize him and cause some issues about a 23 years old guy. Not 23 years old yet. He's turning in November. Lots of expectation. But he was fantastic this year. He was in the GC jersey at the Tirreno Adriatico, won Tour of the Alps, has been fantastic, can drive in and can ride well in all sorts of terrain. I think stage 8 to Fermo goes through his Marche region where he's from, and it will be a crucial stage for GC as well. I'm hyped. I was told not to be too hyped for him before this recording. I'm hyped.
But Pellacci, when you talk about Italian media at the Giro, do you really think that they'll be able to destabilize? There's Ride, there's Giro will be there, there's a good friend from Tutubici. I mean, it's not like there's not a mob of Italian media, you know, causing scrums and there's not a savage kind of atmosphere around the Giro. I mean, am I imagining this the wrong way, or do you really think there's going to be an immense surmounted pressure piling up on Pellizzari? Really,
we're just waiting so much for the savior of Italian cycling. And if Pellizzari turns out to be, or the media pretends him to be, the savior, then the savior label is a lot.
Right.
I'm getting more excited about this Giro with every time Pellacci speaks. The fisherman king versus the savior. I can already see the headlines. This is going to be terrific. Pellacci, you talked about the stage through Le Marche. It's a sort of Tirreno Adriatico type stage through Pellizzari's home region. I was unaware. I read earlier this week, I was doing some reading about Pellizzari, that Le Marche is claimed, Lionel Messi, the Argentine footballer, for the benefit of listeners who don't follow football, if you've never heard of Lionel Messi, he is a footballer. He's claimed by Le Marche. I didn't realize this.
How so?
Did you not know this? I don't know how many generations back.
Me neither.
So? But,
I mean, Messi's an Italian surname. So it's not inconceivable, but maybe that's our mission. But actually, we've been racking our brains for sort of a little investigation. Last year, we found the policeman who foiled the poisoning attempt on Beppe Saronni on the night before he won the Giro d'Italia. What was it, 1983?
That was a good one.
And that was a good one. Brian, we did one with Merckx and in Savona, where we found the hotel where Eddie Merckx was kicked out of the Giro in 1969. Maybe. Again, tenuous cycling link, but finding relatives of Lionel Messi and maybe establishing some link with Giulio Pellizzari, maybe that's our mission.
Interesting. So I was here.
Untangling that mess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm reading right now. In the late years of the 19th century, Lionel Messi's grandparents apparently were from Recanati and San Severino in the Marche. San Severino is where Giulio Pellizzari was born.
So there is a connection. There is a connection.
Why don't we give away too much. Yeah, why are we even going to Bulgaria? We should get to Le Marche 2 weeks early and start working on this investigation. Chaps, let's go through some of the other contenders, because it's certainly, it's not going to be a one-horse race and it's not going to be a two-horse race either. There are other sort of well-established riders with big ambitions at this Giro d'Italia. We're talking about Giulio Pellizzari. I always feel that Jai Hindley gets a bit of a rough deal. He gets underestimated, widely underestimated. He's a former Giro winner, won it in 2022. He's had three Grand Tour top tens since then. He crashed out on the Napoli stage in last year's Giro d'Italia. He was then very good at the Vuelta. He finished fourth at the Vuelta. And it will be interesting to see. We don't know yet. We haven't, as I said earlier, we haven't got the team. We haven't got the sort of statements from Red Bull about how it's going to work in that team. And that's been a bit of a theme already this year. Red Bull going into races with multiple leaders. Who is the real leader? And I think we'll have it again in the Giro. That could be an interesting storyline. Jai Hindley does not have a big ego. And neither, based on current evidence, does Giulio Pellizzari. So that will probably make things easier for them. But who knows? We've also got Derek G. West, who is riding for Lidl this year. Of course, he had his big breakthrough at the Giro a couple of years ago when he was in every breakaway on every day. He was fourth on GC last year after he kind of fluffed Albania last year. He fluffed the sort of first stage and that cost him later. But he was very strong the rest of the race. Fourth last year. Egan Bernal, seventh last year. That was his first GC top 10 since his crash at the start of 2022. Ben O'Connor's had a quiet start to the season, I would suggest, for Jaco Alula. Eighth in Tour of the Alps, third in Catalunya, but he's going with GC ambitions. He had a tour stage win last year, but he missed out on the top 10, sort of agonizingly. Adam Yates, another rider who has had a quiet period, I would suggest. Certainly in Grand Tours. His last podium finish in a Grand Tour was 2023. He was third in the Tour de France. He hasn't had a Grand Tour top 10 since his sixth place in the 2024 Tour de France, but he's had a good start to the season, won El Gran Camino. And in the Giro last year, we remember that he sort of went in again with some GC ambitions, but he ended up helping Del Toro and finishing 12th overall. Who else? We've got Enric Mas, never done the Giro before, if I'm not mistaken. He's had iliac artery surgery, but I saw a video from an interview with him yesterday. He sort of restated that he is going in with GC ambitions. And, you know, there are others. Tymon Arensman as well, very consistent rider. Doesn't produce a lot of fireworks. Another one like Derek G, who messed up in Albania last year. And then we remember he gave this sort of interview the next day where he talked quite candidly, and he's not a rider who generally talks candidly, but he did speak very candidly about how he had this recurring problem of the pressure before Grand Tours. And this had led him to sort of, in his own words, kind of choke at the start of Grand Tours on a couple of occasions. But who knows, maybe he's resolved that now. So he's another one. Brian, what do you make of all of that and all of those names that I've just given you?
Well, a couple of things. It certainly makes it as in contrast to a clear favorite for the pink jersey in Rome. It makes it very open for the rest of the podium, and that in itself will mean, I think, quite the dynamic race, which could also then have an influence on how Vingegaard will have to manage his race, in the sense that as I mentioned earlier, I think he will look at sort of to connect the dots over the 3 weeks. Vingegaard, he knows exactly what he needs to do and when, and I think he can dictate how he wants to apply the pressure and take time from his competitors, basically in between four or five or maybe less key stages for him. But I think the dynamics of how open it is for the remainder of the stages, and I think how those three teams who are in contention for that will, I think they'll dictate the race in some of, could even be in a little bit more of a surprising manner, because I think a lot of the, you know, when you look at the, it's a hard last week, but not as hard as we're used to, right? It's not, there are two hard stages, but they're not four mountaintop finishes in the last week. So I think the it'll not be necessarily a race of attrition. It could also be a bit more of a tactical affair in some of the, you mentioned the Lemarca stage, Pelacci, and I think even, you know, in the Apennine stage, you could see some attacks where the teams who do have two riders will have to play those cards, and they can't just say, well, we'll just see who's going to go and be the better rider in the third week. I think that'll be a waste of genuinely good riders throughout the 3 weeks. I think that would be a way too conservative approach.
Mm. Pelacci, I omitted Félix Gall and Santiago Buitrago from the list of, I would say, sort of second tier favourites. And Giulio Ciccone, well, what's the latest? Ciccone, I always lose track. I mean, 1 year it's GC, next year it's not. He's off the GC beat, isn't he?
We'll see. I think if he's there after Cornole Scale, after stage 9, and doesn't lose too much time in the time trial, maybe he'll make it. Just a perfect announcement with Lidl Trek. They put his name on, you know, on the Giro presentation, they put his name over Italian food. And for Giulio Ciccone, it was arrosticini, which is the, lamb sticks from Abruzzo, his region. Perfect choice. Good job, Lidl Trek. Daniele, I'm looking forward to just sort out which names are going to be in the top 10 in the final GC, which we have no idea about. Just like, I mean, who can remember? Jan Hirt, the Czech guy, he has 2 top 10s at the Giro, 2 times. Who's going to be the near Jan Hirt of the Giro d'Italia 2026? Maybe Jan Hirt himself, he's coming back. Maybe I got Chris Harper from Pinarello Q36.5.
Who, of course, won that famous stage last year. Another, we talked earlier about trivia questions. That would be another good one. Who won the famous Simon Yates Remontada stage? It was Chris Harper.
Yep. I think UAE has an interesting team. Ian Christen, Narvaez. They got Crazy Horse, Cavallo Pazzo, Marc Soler. Antonio Morgado's Grand Tour debut. Interesting, not for GC, of course, but... interesting team, and
it's the deepest team in the Giro, isn't it?
Possibly. Tudor has, with Mathis Rondel, Michael Storer, they got some interesting guys, and it's not a super interesting Giro with these contenders are not the most amazing guys, but it's something. Tymon Arensman, what can we make of Tymon Arensman back at the Giro for the 10th time making GC, and he was 6th in 2 times, I think, in 2024 and 2023. Time announcement, maybe.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're at risk here of lapsing into the realm of speculation, which, of course, we don't tend to do on the Cycling Podcast. Although a preview episode is, in essence, really a speculation episode. We haven't mentioned Storachar either, Michael Storer, or indeed, well, he'll be abetted by our good friend, and you'll be hearing regularly from him over the course of the 3 weeks, Larry Warbass, the Motown Maestro, riding for Tudor Pro Cycling, of course. Chaps, Marc Soler in the Giro d'Italia, that seems out of context. That seems like pineapple on pizza, doesn't it? That seems, I can't quite picture that, the collision of those two worlds, but it could be interesting.
I embrace it. Not the pineapple, but Soler at the Giro.
Could be really, really interesting. Should we just mention as well the sprinters? There are a lot of opportunities for sprinters in this Giro d'Italia, and we'll talk about the route in the third part. I'll pick out a few names for you just as I go down the start list. Again, teams have, on the whole, well, we've got about half of the teams that have been announced. In fact, while we've been recording, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe have announced their team, and it's as suspected, and it's strong, very strong, as we suspected. Jai Hindley, Aliotti, Moscon, Pellizzari, Luke Tuckwell. No, Luke Tuckwell, actually, Pro Cycling Stats have not yet updated the start list, because I've just had a press release from Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, and Luke Tuckwell is not in the team, but he's down on the shortlist per Pro Cycling Stats. So the team is Aliotti, Moscon, Dents, Hindley, Pellizzari, Mick van Dijker, Vlasov, and Ben Zvihoff. So a very strong and very experienced team. But chaps, sprinters, let's get to them. Malucelli of Astana, who has the distinction of being the only rider in the race to have won in the Finnish town of stage 1, Burgas, because he won a stage there in Tour of Bulgaria in 2024, and he also won that race overall. Dylan Groenewegen of Unibet Rose Rockets, the resurgent Dylan Groenewegen, who's had a pretty damn good start to the season there, his new team. Luca Mozzato, at Tudor Pro Cycling. Ackermann, former Giro stage winner, of course, for Jayco Alula. Kasper van Uden is back for Team Picnic post NL Raisin. They've changed their name today. Kasper van Uden, who won in Lecce last year. Am I not mistaken, chaps? Kasper van Uden. Sudal Quickstep, who also have a new jersey. They potentially have the best sprinter in the race, but it's not a rider who's had a particularly happy start to the season. Paul Magnier is back at the Giro d'Italia. He didn't have a particularly happy Giro d'Italia last year either. NSN, they always come with a strong sprint team. Vernon, Corbin Strong and Jake Stewart are all options, I would suggest, in various types of sprint there. Pelacci, are you looking at the list?
I am, and I'm interested
who else can you see?
Lots of guys.
We got Milan, of course.
Of course. Tobias Lutz Andresen from Decathlon. But I have a laser on this guy, Erland Blikra from UnoX. He won in Oman this year, and he was two times second behind Jonathan Milan at the UAE Tour. If this Erland Blikra guy is the first Maglia Rosa at the Giro, you heard him here first, all right?
Okay. Caden Groves, of course, as well, former Giro stage winner. So it's a strong sprint field. And as I said, well, I talked about one of the teams there, NSN, I said they've got options for various types of sprint. We're going to see various types of sprint on this Giro d'Italia. And again, we're going to get the route in a minute. But one of the interesting things about this Giro d'Italia is, well, there are a number of finishes with sort of question marks over them, with climbs in the finale that could lend themselves to big bunch sprints or smaller bunch sprints or even GC battles as well. So that's going to be one of the more interesting aspects of this Giro d'Italia, I would suggest. Would you agree, Brian?
Yeah, as always. And the cool thing also about the sprinters is also that there'll be, you know, we have Milano and Naples, so significant places for a sprinter to claim a stage. And Rome, obviously.
Well, chaps, we are counting down Tuesday, so 2 days before we set sail, Pelacci, and we convene in Sofia, and then we're going to have a long car journey, very long car journey, 4 days across the country, across the middle of Bulgaria, at which point I might be reconsidering some of the choices I've made before this Giro d'Italia. And then we're going to arrive in Burgas. Burgas, is that where we stay, or Nesebar? I can't remember. One of the two. But that Burgas is where the first stage finishes on the Black Sea coast. And I'm very excited about it. I've never been to Bulgaria before the Giro d'Italia. Of course, it's never been to Bulgaria before. Bulgaria, a country with a long history in cycle racing. The Tour of Bulgaria dates back to 1924. I should actually just flag a really excellent sort of primer on the Grande Partenza in Bulgaria on Cycling News by Dan Chalice, who has been doing a lot of excellent work in the last couple of years about sort of global cycling across the world, professional cycling across the world. And Dan's written a really good piece on just the history of cycling in Bulgaria and also various aspects of the Grande Partenza, including the politics in Bulgaria at the moment, and also some of the misgivings that the teams have been expressing ahead of this Grande Partenza about the logistics, because unlike Albania last year, where it was a relatively sort of short hop over the Adriatic for teams to get their vehicles and bikes and everything else back to Italy to resume the race on the fourth day, Bulgaria and Sofia are further away, and I think the teams are going to have two crews effectively, and this is going to be pretty costly. And the organizers of Grand Tours, they do, and Brian, you'll be able to confirm this, they do contribute to the cost that teams incur on these races, but the teams certainly initially when this Grande Partenza wasn't there, were not happy with the amount that was being proposed, and some sort of compromise has been found, but the teams, I think, are still not terribly happy. Just to give you an idea of some of the costs involved, and we've talked about this before, and this is pretty topical at the moment with the fuel crisis, the sort of escalating or developing fuel crisis. We've talked before about how much it costs to fill up, for example, team buses with petrol. I saw a photo from one of the Cofidis director sportifs, Roberto Damiani, a race a couple of weeks ago, and he was traveling in the team bus that just filled up, and he took a picture of the petrol pump, and it was 1300 and something euros to fill up team bus. I spoke to someone else at Tour of the Basque Country, someone working for a team, I can't remember who it was. We were talking about the team budget. Most teams are now spending well over €1 million a year on, certainly if they have women's teams as well, well over €1 million a year on fuel. So that gives you some idea of how onerous the whole thing is. But cycling in Bulgaria itself, a bit of a black box, a bit of a mystery to most of us who are going over there. I thought we'd find out a little bit more about this Grande Partenza and Bulgaria, what awaits us there, by speaking to someone who's become a friend of mine who's been covering races over the last few years, Simeon Kichikov of Eurosport Bulgaria. He briefed me on the Grande Partenza earlier this week.
So I think there's a big excitement in the country. And right now I've been the last 10 days or 2 weeks in several TV stations, in several online medias and some newspapers, just to promote the event, just to explain to the people how big is Giro d'Italia and how important is this for Bulgaria, especially. And I really hope that the people in Bulgaria will understand and will feel the race and the culture of the cycling, the big cycling and grand tours. So normally the big preparations are, I think, started maybe two months and a half. So it was a bit of a little bit of chaos because of this political crisis and the interim government and the new government and the elections last week. So, but normally I've been on the road the last 2 weeks, see the preparations, the road infrastructure, and all the stuff. And I think the preparations are on very good level. The people who are behind this idea, the first are from Sofia municipality. So their idea was to bring the Giro to Sofia, to the capital. But after the first meetings in Italy, the government and the former minister of tourism, he liked the idea. So the government was behind this proposal, candidacy about the Grande Partenza. So that is the main thing. So anything is not possible without the government, in that kind of countries. Well, I think it's the same like every country. Some of the towns are well prepared for cycling and for cyclists. They have bike lanes and bike paths and all the stuff, but some of them are not. Sofia is 50-50 because it's a huge town. It's 2.5 million, so it's very difficult to ride with a bike the whole town, but there's a lot of nice roads, nice climbs, and especially I prefer to ride a bike in smaller towns because the traffic is not so crowded and not so big. But I think in the past few years, maybe Bulgaria has started to improve cycling infrastructure and cycling culture, especially because of cycling is broadcasted all the time in Eurosport, and Eurosport is not paid channel. It's broadcasted from most of the TV stations with basic packet. And there are not a lot of teams, but a few teams in the country. But normally, I think the food and the wines will impress a lot of people. Also, the nature of Bulgaria, because Bulgaria is a very green country, especially in the spring, a lot of forests and mountains, and the seaside, which is very nice. The first stage is very, very beautiful because of these small resorts south of Burgas, and the stage finish of second day in Veliko Trnovo is maybe for me the most beautiful stage and the most beautiful finish. Yeah.
What I've seen, I've had a quick look at the stages. The last bit of that stage is the bit that's most, that kind of most makes me curious. Because the landscape, the location of that town, you know, sort of what it's kind of surrounded by sort of cliffs, isn't it? Inland kind of cliffs. It looks really beautiful on a kind of river bend. And also, but just generally, because there are a few hills, and I think it'll be an exciting race that day as well. And it looks like a very alluring part of Bulgaria that it goes through.
Yeah, yeah. I think this stage will be very exciting. And I hope that one of the, or two, or I don't know, a few of the GC contenders will try to attack. Why not? To take some bonus seconds, so something like that. But I think that the race will be good for the viewers on the TV, and especially for the people who will be on the road, like you and our other colleagues. But I don't know what will impress you less. Maybe the climbs are not so mythical like this in Italy and other countries, but. Arches, they just want to show a lot of from Bulgaria, so they don't care a lot about the climbs or the spectacle.
You personally, are you excited? Because I know what these events are like. I mean, I've been in this position when, for example, the Tour de France is starting in the UK, and it's exciting, but it's also, you feel a bit of pressure and you feel a little bit nervous, because usually you've got a lot of work. And usually you feel a pressure to make the most of it, and you don't really know how to do that sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, I feel the same, because first of all, it's a privilege. Second of all, it's a huge honor. And I'm excited because this will be my first time with the Eurosport team on site, because normally, you know, I work for online medias and I went on my own for some races, and this will be my first time with the top team of Eurosport. So it's a pressure, of course, because everyone wants
to. You're probably the most famous person in cycling in Bulgaria, aren't you? Probably.
I don't know. We'll see.
Pelacci, you've traveled, I wouldn't say, I don't know if it's extensively in Eastern Europe, but you've been traveling in Eastern Europe in the last few weeks, actually. You've been to Bosnia, haven't you? And we've been talking about that. But Bulgaria, how excited are you to get a taste of Bulgaria?
A lot, as always. Also because we are going to places.
Excited about everything, always.
But we're going to places we'll never visit if it wasn't for Giro d'Italia, right? I'll never probably go to the Black Sea ever again in my life. So it interests me how Burgas is going to look, Nessebar. They call it, I've been reading sometimes, the Riccione of the Black Sea. All right, so... the Costa of Romagna, the coast in Emilia-Romagna, my region, not the best place in Italy to go to the sea, but still, you know, good seafood, good people, good weather, and
you fell for the tourist association that's already won one over, right?
That does seem what is positive. What looks positive about this is that there does seem to be quite a bit of excitement in Bulgaria building. In fact, I was on the Visit Bulgaria website yesterday, which has been coloured pink. This was something we sort of lamented last year in Albania. There wasn't enough of this, but it seems, and you would expect this because, the tourist board has very much got behind it. You would expect them to be trying to whip up a lot of excitement, and that seems to be what they're doing. Incidentally, at the Tour of the Basque Country, I spoke to Attila Valta about the impact, the lasting legacy of the Grande Partenza in Hungary, and whether there had been any. In fact, so I think we can hear a little bit of that now, what Attila told me.
Super hard to tell, no? Definitely, but I'm lucky to say that it's hard to tell for me, because I don't know if it was already so good before the Giro, or I just feel like now it's just when the sun starts to shine, the first weeks of spring, for example, there is insane how many cyclists are around. So for sure it had a nice impact, and we see also in the coffee shop that a lot of people arriving with bikes and a lot of people interested in bikes and cycling at the SS Sports itself. So for sure it had a nice impact in general, and also just in more commonly in the whole country, that people know about cycling. Everyone knows what is Giro d'Italia now, and not just the Tour de France or not just cycling itself, but everyone knows what is the Giro. So I would say yes, for sure, it's changed as much as it could change.
So there you go. Hopefully for the Bulgarians, it will be more of a Bulgaria than an Albania in terms of legacy and in terms of promoting cycling in Bulgaria. Looking forward to the food, chaps. I'm curious about the food, the wine, of course. And in terms of delicacies, in terms of the cuisine, I think it's a lot like, there are certain similarities with other Eastern European countries based on what I've been reading, but I'm looking forward to trying this banitsa, which is sort of a pastry made with a phyllo pastry with cheese. The stuffed cabbage, you generally find that in Eastern Europe. We went on a sort of side quest to find the stuffed cabbage in Hungary with Lionel. We did eventually locate it. Not saying it was that memorable, but you know, we're going to get a bit of that, I think, as well in Bulgaria. So pretty excited. But chaps, generally, let's pivot to talk more generally about the route itself. And I'd sort of forgotten how I felt about the route until I dived back into it again this week. And Brian, we had an experience a couple of years ago when Tadej Pogacar did the Giro d'Italia, and a route that on paper didn't look very exciting, I didn't think. And then I remember at the end of the first week, we were raving about how on every day, and this was partly because of Pogacar himself and the way he went into that Giro very aggressively, but on every day there was something, there was some kind of launch pad, springboard, in particularly in the finales. And I'm hoping it's going to be the case in this Giro. But generally speaking, looking again at the route, what are your broad brush strokes impression of this route?
It's an easier route than we're used to. Shorter stages again. Irrelevant to our listeners, a lot of transfers, but that's not irrelevant to the riders. I said there's generally shorter stages, but there's also an incredibly long stage. The first big mountain stage is the longest Grand Tour stage since 2021, I believe.
How long is it, Brian?
249 kilometers, which is mad. A lot of southern Italy, which is always interesting when you think of. I mean, it's always a bit of a discovery to see how the road roads are down there. I like it. Sometimes I find, I mean, it's a cliche, but I think there's some merit to repeating it, that it's not always that a harder parcours gives more exciting racing. And I think with the dynamic that we spoke about earlier of a rather large crowd of contenders for the other podium placings, I hope that this architecture could install some excitement with the race being somewhat open just below Vingegaard, that we have these somewhat not super hard mountain stages that could give some excitement maybe in unexpected places. I look forward to going to Le Marche. I do look forward to seeing a bit more of the south. The tour passes several places I've lived in Italy as well. Excited about that. I think the mountain stages are less, but the Dolomites are phenomenal. I mean, there are some this is your domain, Daniel, but I think that the one really hard Dolomite stage is could be a decider if things haven't been decided yet. So yeah, I mean, and also it goes without saying, we talked about the fuel bit before. Traveling from Friuli to Rome in lieu of all of this is as stupid as it ever was. But yeah, there you go. This decision they've just continuously tried to think they should make.
Palacci.
The more I look at the route, I think I love more and more the first week. The first 9 days, actually. You got the possibility of 3, 4, 5 Maglia changes in the very first stages. Then probably Jonas Vingegaard or a GC guy will take the Maglia on the blockhouse. But the first week ends with mountaintop finish on blockhouse. The Muri Marchigiani stage, super good stage as always, will be in Fermo. And then another mountaintop finish at Corno Le Scale. very good stuff. What I don't like is the second week. It's too weak. It's you got the sprinter stage in Milan on a Sunday. And the final week, you know, the Dolomites stage is amazing. I love that final. I love Passo Giao. I've been there with my bike. Amazing. Go there. It's just 151 kilometers long. And that's, I have an issue with.
I feel like that was a bit of a gift to like, or a bit of a, like a handshake to Vingegaard. You know, that like, oh, we'll do a hard stage, but we won't overdo it. I mean, yeah, it was a bit unnecessary to make it that short, but yeah, I agree with you, Pelagi.
I think, Charles, the fear that I have, always have nowadays before the Giro d'Italia is this kind of configuration we've often got of the transitional stages and to a certain extent the flat stages as well, where we get, and no disrespect to Polti visit Malta and Bandiani, but we get the sort of three Italian Conti teams sending riders down the road, and we don't get the main element that's made the Grand Tours such a great watch over the last few years, and that is the really, really exciting first 2 hours. And you know, I've talked quite a lot this year about the acceleration in the first hour in Grand Tours in the last 5 years particularly, but if you go back over the last 10 years, you see a pattern that the Giro d'Italia every single year except last year has had the slowest first hours of the Grand Tours. And it's quite significantly so. And particularly compared to the Tour de France, you would expect that. But it's about 2 kilometers, 2+ kilometers an hour slower on average the first hour of the Grand Tours in the Giro compared to the Tour. And that is, well, I mean, why is that? Is it because of an absence of terrain in the first 50 kilometers of stages, which sort of incentivizes some of the bigger teams to try something? Is it, I mean, there are even people who think there are echoes of something very sort of historical in Italian cycling, this paradigm you used to get with Italian cycling where races would finish on city circuits, and the racing would only start when the race got to the city or got to the little town. And then there's also television. That is an aspect of it as well, that historically, you know, the TV only started in the last 2 hours for the Giro and the racing only started there. I don't know whether there's any sort of trace, any remnants of that now, but I sort of don't want to see that really. Again, no disrespect to Bardiani and Polti. And you also don't really want Vingegaard to have a significant lead early in the race, and Visma Lisa bike are happy to let the brakes go, and the guys behind are happy to finish. You know, Pellizzari's happy to finish second, Adam Yates is happy to finish third, and the race just gets kind of stuck. That's what I don't want to happen. I think those stages with a question mark, there are a few stages where I think Little Trek will figure out quite early how well Milan is climbing and whether it's worth working for him on days with a little climb towards the end. And that will affect things quite a lot, because that's a team that really, really commits when they think their sprinter has a chance, in the fashion that we've seen with Mads Pedersen over the last few years. The other thing that could be interesting, and it sounds, we've sort of mocked this or this kind of thing, it seems gimmicky, but the Red Bull kilometer, I still none the wiser as to why it's a kilometer, why it's not just a line. It just seems like a device to put Red Bull advertising hoardings over a kilometer rather than a couple hundred meters. But the Red Bull kilometer is essentially another intermediate sprint. But the significant thing is that there are bonus seconds, 6 bonus seconds, 6-4-2. And that is a significant amount. If you won every Red Bull bonus sprint, you would gain 2 minutes over the 3 weeks. So it's worth going for. And significantly this year, they're very close to the finish generally. Generally, within the last 30 kilometers, there are a couple at 32, 42, but generally they're in the last 30 kilometers, a lot of them in the last 15 kilometers. And that's going to be interesting, you know, without going through day by day and saying exactly where they are. That should act as a bit of a prelude on a lot of days to the real action starting. We might see some sort of quirky, funky things happening because of these Red Bull kilometers, which I think is interesting.
More interesting than last year, for sure. But generally, I think this year's route resembles what's been sort of the paradigm of last year's. You've got similarities all over the place. You've got stage three. It's basically the same as last year in Albania. You've got stage 10, an individual time trial in northern Tuscany, just like last
year. Stage two as well, Pelacci, is very similar to stage one last year.
Exactly. Plus, you've got the first stage of the third week is a sort of medium mountain terrain. You've got the breakaway stage in the third week before the final mountains. Very similar. And this is what I mean when I say that this Giro d'Italia has been less attractive for two reasons. One is the fact that RCS has not been inventive, has not been... For example, Daniele, in the first week of the Giro d'Italia, I'll be going to Calvanico to ride Capo Calvanico, this super, infamous climb in near Napoli. The Giro has never even thought of going up there. And you've got some, regions that... just the plot is missing. There is something missing, as you mentioned before. But also some reasons... because the Giro is less attractive this year, are peculiar to this edition only. For example, imagine if Paul Sexton was not going to the Tour de France and was going to this Giro. Would have changed everything, right? The eyes of the cycling world would be on the Giro.
Yeah, Brian made a really interesting point before we started recording. I think you're dead right, Brian. We talked about the Giro being, unfortunately, compared to the Tour de France, it is a little bit B-list. And we talked about Sexas's announcement yesterday having overshadowed to a certain extent the build-up to the Giro. And the Giro, if you look back, and, Pelacci, Brian and I get sort of misty-eyed about the Giro d'Italia from the turn of the millennium. But they were always a little bit, in terms of quality, if you were to be brutal about them, you would always say they were a long way short of the Tour de France. And you saw this, guys would win the Giro and they would declare, Gibo Simoni would declare that he was going to take on Armstrong at the Tour. Then he'd go to the Tour and Armstrong would wipe the floor with him, the controversial Lance Armstrong. And so they were always a level, definitely a level or two below. But what saved it was the fact that they were hard fought between Italians mainly, and this created a lot of excitement. Now, Brian, you said, and you're absolutely right, that the organizers, they're desperate to have a big star, a headline act, and they got it 2 years ago with Pogacar, they got it this year with Vingegaard, and that they sort of set out at the start of every year to get one, to snare a big beast. They've got Vingegaard. The problem with that is that if Vingegaard then absolutely dominates the race, then you've got a race that doesn't feel quite the same quality as the Tour, and you don't have the really intense competition either. And there's a bit of sort of double jeopardy there.
Yeah, it's a selfish kind of prestige almost for the RCS to have that golden calf almost, that they want that prestigious, oftentimes now, for the lack of an Italian one, foreign rider. That would sort of give them that type of attention. And because they have this inferiority complex, them being Italians, reflected all the way into the fact that, you never hear a yellow jersey winner being asked one single question about what their relationship to France is. They don't care. Mm. They don't care. They know they're great. Mm. They know they have the greatest race. It's absolutely irrelevant to them. But it would be, as you say, Daniel, it would be a way more interesting race if it was an even playing field without that one marquee superstar. And it's just, for the lack of a better word, it's a fetish for the RCS to have that. And it's an inferiority complex that they extrapolate onto the rest of us. And I understand it, but it's for commercial reasons. More than sporting ones, because it doesn't really add anything to the sporting spectacle. On the contrary, it really takes away a lot of potentially takes away a lot of excitement. I understand why it meant the world to them to have Pogacar, but there we had a guy who then won more than a handful of stages and the overall race with 10 minutes. There's no argument for that making it a quality bike race, right? I mean, it just makes it a triumph. Of 3 weeks, it doesn't really do anything more than that, in my opinion.
Well, Brian, the listeners can rest assured that we will bring the excitement. We will be the best thing about this Giro d'Italia.
Well, joking aside, I mean, it ironically, it's still the Grand Tour that I love being at the most, because of the atmosphere, because of the people, because of the places, because of everything else. So nothing takes away from that. But we're still to see what the racing will bring, right? And we do tend to become positively surprised also on.
Yeah. I mean, some of our concerns are based on recent history. Really, we've had a couple of editions. Not every one of the last recent editions has been underwhelming. There were parts of last year that were incredible. I mean, we got to the end of last year's race with people saying, oh, this is the greatest grand tour, you know, that I've seen in the last few years. There was a lot of recency bias in that because the penultimate stage was an absolute sort of epoch-defining, brilliant stage. But we've seen other editions. 2022 was not the greatest edition. But I think we could be proven wrong, and it will be things that we're not even considering now. I mean, I mentioned Little Trek, and we always look at the GC teams. Are the GC teams going to make the GC battle exciting? Well, often what makes the GC battle exciting is not the GC teams, it's the teams that are working for a sprinter or the teams that are working to get that guy in the break or whatever. So there's so much that could surprise us and delight us, and probably will, chaps. So we're going to look forward to that. We're going to be talking a lot about Italy as well. Brian, we're going to play now a clip in which we hear John Foote also maligning something else in Italy. I'm not going to play it because I don't want to bring people down. But those of you, friends of the podcast in particular, who want a sort of a cultural, historical foreground to this Giro d'Italia, I think you'll enjoy my conversation with John Foote. We talk a lot about Italy, where Italy's at, things like over-tourism in Italy, which has become a huge topic of conversation in the last couple of years in Italy. What can be done about it? Why you should still go to Italy anyway, because it's the most beautiful country in the world, and so on and so forth. So that's coming on Thursday. But chaps, anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
I've got something.
Go on.
Major news from Bulgaria, because soccer wise or football wise, something happened. Because after 14 years of dominance, local team Ludogorets did not win the local championship, the local campionato, the Bulgarian Serie A. It was Levski Sofia indeed. Major news for Bulgarian sports.
Nothing like ending on a bit of a soccer news. For the Giro preview.
Just to get rid of the last remaining listeners who have hung on this long. Anyway, chaps, we will be bringing the vibes, won't we? We'll be bringing the vibes. We'll be bringing the ciclismo from Bulgaria on Friday. I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to seeing you, Pelacci, on Thursday in Sofia. And Brian, looking forward to seeing you from
Monday.
Lamezia Terme is where we're meeting up. The stage the following day is Catanzaro to Cosenza, if it's not the other way around.
It is.
And you'll be with me then for about 10 days until the second rest day. Is that second rest day? And then Pelacci, you'll be coming in for the mountain stages, Switzerland, Dolomites, and all that. So, chaps, until then, thank you very much in the meantime.
A presto. Thanks, guys.
Ciao.
Grazie mille.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.